Michael Shapcott is the Director of Affordable Housing and Social Innovation at the Wellesley Institute in Toronto. Michael is recognized as one of Canada's leading community-based housing and homelessness experts. He leads the Wellesley Institute's Housing and Homelessness Practice and co-leads the Wellesley Institute's Social Innovation Practice. One Friday afternoon in November, I met with Michael at the Wellesley Institute, and I interviewed him on his expertise on the issues of homelessness. Thanks, Michael Shapcott, for having me here at your office today. So maybe we could just start off with you introducing yourself, telling us a little bit about your role, and a little bit about the Wellesley Institute.
My name is Michael Shapcott. I'm Director of Affordable Housing and Social Innovation here at the Wellesley Institute. We're about 10 years old or so. The Wellesley Institute is a legacy institution of the old Wellesley Hospital, which for about almost a century provided primary health care services in the east end of downtown Toronto. Towards the end of its life, because it was working in neighborhoods like the Church Wellesley neighborhood, had a very active LGBT practice, HIV/AIDS, that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. In the late 1980s and into the 1990s, there began to be some questions about the Wellesley Institute on the part of the provincial government, and towards the end of the 1990s, the government decided it would shut down the hospital. This was a controversial decision. The community, many parts of the community, tried to stop the hospital from being closed. Unfortunately, they weren't successful, but the trustees of the hospital decided to turn over the land, the endowment, other assets of the hospital to the Wellesley Institute. So we carry on as a legacy of the old hospital. Mm. Our focus is on advancing urban health, which broadly speaking is almost everything in life, ultimately affects people's health. But over the years, we've really focused in a few areas. We've focused in terms of funding various kinds of community-based research that more traditional funders don't look at. Mm-hmm. So over the years, we had quite a large stream of funding in the early years around HIV/AIDS, around LGBTQ issues, services and so on in the community. Again, partly because of our legacy to the old Wellesley Hospital, but also recognizing the neighborhood that we are based in and do much of our work. We also, because we are a research institute, a think tank, we generate lots of great research with our partners. We also understand that, unfortunately, good research doesn't sell itself, that in order to get policy impact, to get politicians, to get other people who can make a difference to actually do something, we have to have a dedicated policy initiative that supports our research. So that's really mainly what my role is here at the Wellesley Institute. Mm-hmm. Is working on the policy side. Other people are generating the research and the ideas, and I'm taking them into the public sphere. In particular, I work in a couple of areas in our housing and homelessness practice. So I lead that, and also a related practice called social innovation, which is really looking at strengthening non-governmental organizations, non-profit organizations in the community that are working to create better services, stronger neighborhoods, that sort of thing.
Wow, sounds like a lot of really great things happen here.
Yeah, it's an amazing place, quite unique, Canadian international context. Mm-hmm. In the early years, we were very much focused in the east end of downtown Toronto, which is the roots of the old Wellesley Hospital, the old footprint of the Wellesley Hospital. But over the years, we've added staff and begun to realize that many of the issues and concerns that are in our neighborhood, there are actually good practices, good solutions in other parts of the city, other parts of the country, other parts of the world. So in the last decade, we've expanded. We now have several international initiatives. We do partnerships in other communities. We have a wide variety of research initiatives that touch on a whole range of issues. In the early years, we kind of sat back and waited for people to come to us with great ideas. In more recent years, what we decided to do is to be a bit more focused and to look at areas we think are really important that nobody else is paying attention to and fund those areas. But if you look over our website, and we've got over 100 research reports and policy documents posted on our website, and they range from issues that are very specific to things like supportive housing for people with HIV/AIDS, through to payday lending issues, and a whole health equity and a whole variety of other initiatives in between.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so when did you become involved in work regarding housing and anti-poverty, and what sort of drew you to that, to this type of work?
I started my first real job when I left high school was working for a newspaper. So I was very attracted, this would be in the early 1970s, very attracted to the idea. This seems like centuries ago now, long before the age of personal computers and all that sort of thing, but very much attracted to the journalism, to writing. And in those days, among journalists, our heroes were people like Woodward and Bernstein at the Washington Post, who had spoken truth to power, who had exposed corruption at the highest levels of the U.S. government, brought down a corrupt president, Richard Nixon. And I was, of course, somewhat less dramatic than that. I was working in a small daily newspaper in Northern Ontario, but filled with much of the same idea that there was something very powerful in telling stories that had a purpose and a relevance to people. For 10 years, I was involved in journalism, ended up in the Calgary Albertan, which is a daily newspaper, or was a daily newspaper in Calgary, where I was associate editor and ran the editorial page. All through the time, I was mostly concentrating on urban issues, a lot of concentration on housing things. Began to get a bit frustrated with the notion in mainstream journalism that journalists have to kind of stand apart from and outside of community, that they can't really get involved in things. You're supposed to be objective. And I don't think that anyone can be objective who lives in the world. I think we all necessarily get involved, take sides, and that's a good thing. So I decided after 10 years in journalism to go to law school, where I did some legal work representing tenants. And drawing from that, when I left law school, I started working in the mid-1980s in the east end of downtown Toronto, helping to build affordable housing. So I was mainly working with homeless adults, some homeless youth, working on various housing projects. And as the national and provincial housing programs began to wind down in the early 1990s and mid-1990s, I shifted more and more into policy and advocacy work. First of all, working for a national housing organization for about a decade, and then going to University of Toronto, and then eventually ending up about 6 years ago here at the Wellesley Institute, where I set up and have run the housing practice here at the Wellesley for that period of time.
Wow, that's a very interesting history that you have.
It sort of spans a number of things, but really animated by a number of notions. One notion is that our work, in order to put people at the center, that as a society we tend to relegate people who are different because of their poverty status, their income status, because of their racial identity, because of their sexual orientation. We tend to relegate certain people into certain categories and say that, you know, sometimes that we have to do stuff for them, or sometimes we have to just exclude them. My experience in housing and homelessness work is that it actually is possible to engage people in very interesting and meaningful work, and people can be active agents for change. And that's been a real focus of my work throughout.
That's great. And so since you've been involved in this work for quite some time now, what would you say, like, how has the face of homelessness changed in Toronto since you first got involved to now?
When I started working in the mid-1980s, the majority of people who were what we would call visibly homeless, people living in shelters or people on the streets, were single men, often middle-aged or older men, people who may have had an alcohol or drug use issue. We didn't see that many young people. There certainly weren't children. It was very rare. I can still remember the first time in the 1980s that we came across a family who was actually living absolutely homeless. And then in the 1990s, I remember the first time that I saw a pregnant woman who actually ended up giving birth while she was living on the streets. And these were stunning things back then. What's changed as mass homelessness has risen in the 1990s is that it's gone from being very much a fringe for the people involved. But I don't want to minimize the terrible burden of homelessness for Aboriginal people and for primarily the men who were homeless back in the 1980s and earlier. It was a terrible situation, but relatively speaking, the numbers were small. And what's changed over the years has been just a massive flow of people of all kinds into the street. We've seen, it seems like every few years we see a new wave of people in the early part of this century. We began to see large numbers of seniors coming onto the street. There's now estimated there are 7,800 seniors in Toronto's homeless shelters. What's staggering about that is that there's not a single homeless shelter that's set up to meet the physical or mental health needs of seniors.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that one of the factors that has generated that were changes in the tenant protection laws in the late 1990s, which allowed landlords to evict tenants very, very quickly, within 5 working days, sometimes even less, and that many people were actually evicted before they even knew that there was a problem in terms of their tenancy. So we've seen a number of factors that have triggered this real change in the face of homelessness. It's not just here in Toronto, it's of course throughout the country.
Yeah.
And one of the explanations, I have to say to you, that one of the simplistic explanations, which is simply not a true explanation,
mm-hmm.
is that one of the factors that's driven the increase in mass homelessness in Canada in the 1990s and into this century has been a policy of deinstitutionalizing, shutting down the old lunatic asylums or mental hospitals that really started in the 60s but took pace and really picked up in the 70s and into the 80s. And so there's this sort of rather simplistic theory that homeless people are all crazy people who got dumped out of the asylums, they're now on the streets.
Yeah.
In fact, that's not, although there are serious mental health issues among people who are homeless on the streets, in many cases, of course, those issues arise because of life on the street. It's not that they were crazy and became homeless, it's that they're homeless and the very stresses and fractures of life on the street make them crazy. So I would say that what's been in many ways sort of really striking about beyond the fact that just simply the sheer numbers are overwhelming and in every part of Canada the numbers are quite staggering. I do want to say one other thing about the changing face of homelessness that back in the 80s when I first started doing street level community organizing with homeless people in East End of downtown Toronto, a good number of people were able to cycle in and out of low-end housing, what we call rooming houses. Some cities call it SRO housing, single-room occupancy
mm-hmm.
housing. They were able to get sort of marginal jobs on the fringe of the economy, doing day labor, that sort of thing. They'd scrape together enough money to get a room for a week or a month, and then back out in the street again, and they kind of cycle in and out of that sort of situation. Because of the changing nature of the labor economy, those kinds of jobs are no longer there for people who are homeless, and that's really changed the situation. We're actually seeing more and more people now who are homeless who actually have what might be called regular jobs. In cities like Calgary, more than a third of the people who stay in homeless shelters actually have well-paying jobs by any standard in the construction industry, in the service sector, and so on. But the cost of housing is so high, they just simply can't get it. I can't think of anybody back in the when I first started among the many groups, many people that I knew, young people and older people who were homeless, that had any kind of reasonable employment that were homeless. If you had a reasonable employment back then, you could find somewhere to live.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can't. So we're finding people who are employed are among the homeless.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like in many ways the situation has actually gotten a lot worse, but in other ways maybe there have been, you know.
The depending on how you measure these sorts of things, in terms of the overall numbers, I do have to take a step back and say that one of the things that I find most shocking as a housing advocate is what a bad job we do about just measuring and understanding the basics of homelessness. We don't, for instance, even have a national definition, an accepted national definition of homelessness,
yeah.
And that may sound like it's a stupid, pedantic kind of, you know, who really cares except a bunch of obscure academics who want to argue about definitions. Well, actually, it means a lot because without, first of all, having the basic definition, we can't then go out and start to count people and then measure numbers and start to determine whether all the funding and programs that are geared to homelessness are actually making a difference in people's lives. Because homeless people are invisible, they're not counted, it becomes very impossible. We do have a number of informal measures that do chart how serious the homeless problem is, and they're kind of indicators around the edges, things like the number of people staying in homeless shelters, the number of people who are counted during street surveys, who are sleeping rough in the streets, the numbers of people who use various services and programs for homeless people like food banks, soup kitchens, and so on. There's been a huge amount of information, all of which clearly documents there's been an explosion in the overall numbers in all those categories. Another thing we've been able to really document in absolutely gruesome detail are issues around the health status of homeless people. The Wellesley Institute has played a role, along with many others, in terms of documenting the burden of illness and premature death faced by homeless people. It's absolutely staggering. You know, for anyone who has any illusion that somehow being homeless is carefree because you don't have to worry about paying the rent or paying the mortgage and you can just sort of spend your day however you want to spend it, the fact is that it is literally a death sentence. Premature mortality rates for homeless people are many times the similar rate for people who are housed, and that goes for youth who are homeless, it goes for older people who are homeless, in every category in between. As well, the burden of illness, virtually every kind of category of illness that you can imagine, the prevalence is higher in the homeless population. A couple of years ago, we funded Street Health, which is a street-level nursing service for homeless people, to do an update of a report they had done a decade or so earlier on the health status of homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
And in their new report, one of the observations they made overall is that homeless people don't really have different diseases than the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
But the diseases that we all as human beings face, homeless people have them in greater prevalence. So mental health issues much higher among homeless people, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, respiratory illnesses, and so on. You go down the whole sort of gruesome list.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I think that, well, it's kind of hard to say whether this has really changed in the last 30 or 40 years, the sort of relative burden of illness. One thing that's very clear is that as we've gotten more and more research, a much clearer picture has emerged about how absolutely devastating and how lethal homelessness is in the lives of individuals, and I think that's something that's emerged extremely clearly. And there can be no one in Canada who can argue that homelessness is not that serious an issue. In relative terms, we have fewer homeless people here in Canada than in India, for instance, but homeless people in Canada died just as surely as they die in India.
Mm-hmm.
And life is just as miserable for them in terms of the burden of illness. So I think that's an important dimension of the work, and we've been very much wanting to take that message out because one of the many lies that is out there is that people choose to be homeless, that young people decide that they'd rather be carefree and live a life of irresponsibility in the street than have to be at home and go to school and follow the rules of the household. For older people, there are notions that people would rather be homeless than have to have a job and work 9 to 5. Mm-hmm. And when you begin to look at the reality of life as a homeless person, you realize that nobody is choosing this life. Nobody's choosing a life of illness and premature death.
Yeah.
And it really, I think, undercuts very powerfully this pathology that's developed as mass homelessness has arisen in Canada, the sort of pack of lies that's been perpetuated to explain it, is that suddenly we've had this rise in irresponsibility and laziness and so on, and that's why we've got so many more homeless people now. It's because so many more people are choosing, quote-unquote, the life of homelessness.
Right. And do you believe that that we will actually find strategies that work to end homelessness?
Well, the good news story as well, and this is also something I can say from our work here at the Wellesley Institute, but also from the fact that I get to travel a lot across Canada and meet with people who have experienced homelessness, meet with people who are working on the front lines in every part of the country. And what's absolutely amazing to me is that in every community, you can find these absolutely amazing projects where people are engaged in effective, practical, humane solutions mm-hmm. to homelessness, and you name a sort of particular issue. A couple of weeks ago, I was up in Whitehorse in Yukon, where there's a terrible concern around an illness known as fetal alcohol syndrome, which is an absolutely devastating health condition, and almost overwhelming to think about. The impact that has on the ability of people to live in the world and to thrive in the world. But there are people who have developed effective strategies to ensure people are housed with dignity, provided with the supports and services they need in order to gain some measure of control over their lives. And you can sort of multiply that all across the country. One of the things that we've done at the Wellesley Institute is a way, and this is our very modest contribution, because there just literally are thousands and thousands and thousands of examples of effective initiatives. We set up on our website the Canadian Housing eMap. It's on our homepage, wellesleyinstitute.com. It's a crowdsourcing application, so basically it's a Google Map, and we've asked people to send in information about successful local initiatives they've done to address housing and homelessness issues. And we have 179 wow. initiatives so far. The goal of this EMAP is to make very real, in a tangible kind of way, the fact that what's stopping us from solving the homelessness crisis, what's stopping us from solving the affordable housing crisis, not that we don't know what to do, or that we don't have solutions for specific needs of particular populations, what's stopping us is political will, because mm-hmm. we do actually have great solutions everywhere in the country.
Right.
And maybe the folks up in Whitehorse haven't yet heard about the great stuff that people in St. John's are doing with women released from prison, and maybe the people in St. John's haven't yet looked at the injection drug user work that's being done in the downtown east side of Vancouver. And part of the goal of our map is to actually to begin to surface some of that, so people can begin to say, that initiative is working very successfully in that neighborhood, is one that could work in my neighborhood. Tweak it a little bit, make it locally relevant. But the key message I really want to sort of drive home about the affordable housing crisis is that it's getting worse not because we don't know what to do. It's getting worse because the people that can make a difference, the policymakers, are refusing to apply the solutions that we know are there.
In terms of youth homelessness, mm-hmm. I'm just going to sort of shift the focus a little
sure.
bit here. In terms of youth homelessness, do you think that we actually have an understanding of the complexities of youth homelessness, or do you think that we lack research in that field?
Because I straddle the research and the policy side, I'm always interested in knowing more about stuff. And I think we can always, always, always know more about you name it, mm-hmm. In terms of youth homelessness. There's always more stuff we can know, but at the same time, we don't need to know everything in order to start doing stuff mm-hmm. to solve the issue. one of the big drivers of youth homelessness, we absolutely know one of the big factors that is driving is sexual and physical violence. We know that young people youth who end up on the streets are often there because they're leaving situations of violence. And for them, the choice, if I can use that phrase, and I hate the word choice in the context of homelessness, because I think people often don't really have a choice, is stay in a situation of violence or leave and face other kinds of violence in terms of life on the street. So we do know that, and we do know that there are some issues that can be addressed in terms of youth homelessness. We know another issue with youth homelessness is a combination of economics and housing supply. And by that I mean that unemployment, for instance, among young people is extraordinarily high compared to the adult population, which is already bad enough, but for youth, extraordinarily high. And so therefore, you know, the sort of simple and simplistic solution to ensuring everyone is housed in Canada is make sure everyone has enough money they can go out and either rent or buy a house. Well, with the unemployment rate so high, that simply is not possible. So we know addressing youth unemployment is a critical issue. We also know that even if youth have money, that they're often systematically discriminated against in the job market. We do know as well that policymakers have a set of blinkers when it comes to youth. They don't understand the realities of youth homelessness. Most provinces, including Ontario, don't have very effective strategies for instance, people who are leaving care, who are wards of the state, who, in other words, been brought into some kind of care situation, and then at 18, they're kind of put out. There isn't, it's very hard for them to rent housing. It's, there aren't youth-oriented housing projects. There is a group here in Toronto that has been, I think, for at least 8 or 10 years now, been trying to get a youth housing project funded. And not only can they not get the attention of private funders like banks and so on who won't touch it because they don't think it's worth their support financially, but they can't get governments to look at it, and they have a perfectly good business plan to develop a housing project. So in terms of on the research side, there's always more work we can do because we know that there are a number of particular issues that may be in particular parts of Canada may be triggering increases in terms of youth homelessness. Always good to continue to study that. Always good to look at solutions, to test solutions. I'm a great believer in the idea that everything should be evaluated to determine whether it is actually successfully meeting the needs of the people that are that need the particular program or service. But fundamentally what we need in Canada is we need a kind of giant wake-up call. Last year there were a couple of sort of bookended conferences that were held on youth homelessness and that were, although they were supported by various organizations, they were really youth-led conferences. Mm-hmm. And what was extremely powerful in these conferences was the sort of intelligence and the fact that I don't want to say any more because it sounds condescending, and it really the one thing lesson I've learned over 30 years of working on housing and homelessness stuff is that homeless people aren't stupid. They're actually extremely smart. They've been marginalized economically, racially, socially, in other ways, but they're not stupid. And I guess what I want to say is that the two youth summits that were held, including one here in Toronto, where hundreds and hundreds of young homeless people from across the country came together, is absolute proof that young people know what the solutions are, but nobody's listening to them. Nobody, yeah. That is to say, who can make a difference in terms of policymakers. And so one of the important roles of organizations like the Wellesley Institute is to try and bridge that gap between the youth population that really know what the solutions are and the policymakers, and so we try and provide a bit of that bridge.
Right. Actually, that leads really nicely into my next question. So a very important part of the work that I do is the knowledge translation piece. And it's an ongoing struggle for me, and I know as well for other researchers and other academics, to find that bridge between the academic work and the social activism piece, and even just getting people in the broader society to listen and to educate them and to create movement, to create a shift. What do you think about that? Like, how do we as researchers create that bridge? How do we step into the world and work as social justice activists as well?
Well, I recognize that there's long been a tension. I worked for 6 years at the University of Toronto, and I know that there are some who believe that the scholar is merely engaged in expanding the body of knowledge in the world, and the role of the scholar is simply to sort of expand that knowledge, and that's it. Yeah. And it's up to other people to take that and do with it what they want in terms of making a difference in the world. I also know there's another very powerful trend in academia the role of the researcher is actually to make a difference, to make a change in and not simply just to better understand things, but to create a better world, to paraphrase Karl Marx, who, you know, whatever you may think about some of his other ideas, he was dead right about that. And the thing that drives, I have to say, the thing that drives the Wellesley Institute is the notion that we're action-oriented. We don't believe it's good enough just to discover something interesting or new, and then go and say, hey, did you realize that this, we just discovered this fascinating little fact? Isn't that cool? And then we all go out and have a beer and pat ourselves on the back. It's about actually taking knowledge and using it in order to drive the agenda. I think part of it then comes down to the question of who decides what knowledge is and who decides what is sort of truth and valid. And there is, in some spheres of academia, a notion that numbers and quantitative sort of so-called hard research is important, and stories and experiences and the sort of qualitative material is fluff, and it's just color and it's, you know, a meringue. We believe very much that where it's possible to get numbers, that numbers are extremely important to have. We think, as I started off by saying, you know, we don't know, for instance, in Toronto, how many young people are homeless, and that's an important number to know, and I would love to be able to have that very precise number, but that's not the only piece of knowledge we need to know about youth homelessness in Toronto. We also need to understand the lived experiences, and we have to gain that experience. And we won't get that experience by sitting in an office somewhere and contemplating a spreadsheet. You get that information by actually engaging with people. We, in as much of our research as we can, engage peer researchers. So I'll go back to the Street Health Report. When we were working with Street Health and funding that, it was actually homeless people who designed the surveys, who administered the surveys, and who analyzed the research. I have a colleague at University of Toronto, Val Terazak, who does a lot of work on nutrition. And I remember a while back she was talking about some work she did with youth and nutrition. And she, of course, does the same sort of thing, has peer researchers. And one of the things Val said was that sitting around a table with people who actually have experienced, youth who've experienced homelessness, but who are now sitting and trying to provide some understanding and analysis of the stories that were collected as part of the survey process, they actually had insights that were very deep and profound. Various policy people refer to this as mining research, and the way you mine research is by getting people who have lived experience to actually tell you what all this stuff means. Mm-hmm. And I think an essential part of the knowledge translation process is making sure that the knowledge that we're conveying is not just simply what somebody else says is what the world looks like, but it's what people who are living those experiences have to say. So I think part of the process that provides a real sense of power. We did a little while back a report called We Are Neighbors. We funded a report called We Are Neighbors, which looks at supportive housing in a couple of Toronto neighborhoods. Supportive housing is housing for people who have mental health issues. And generally the notion, to be very crude about it, is that people who have a diagnosed mental health problem are probably too crazy to have much of a contribution to make to the world. We actually thought they're the perfect people to be involved as peer researchers, actually doing a study on looking at issues like the impact of supportive housing on crime rate, on housing prices, and on the economic footprint of the neighborhood. And so we worked with a group of peer researchers, and they developed a really excellent piece of work called We Are Neighbors, mm-hmm. which combines some quantitative and some qualitative stuff. One of the things I think that's most important, though, in the knowledge translation is to actually understand one of the things that's been happening. There's been quite a profound erosion within government at all levels, federal, provincial, municipal, in terms of on the policy side. Take an example, Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. Back in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, it was, and it still is, but it was back then, Canada's federal government's lead agency on housing and homelessness issues. And they had staff all across the country and communities right across the country. They were actually engaged very deeply in this work, starting in 1995, but with changes to the National Housing Act in 1998, when CMHC was commercialized, the policymaker shifted the focus from CMHC away from working on housing and homelessness issues to selling mortgage insurance. And if you look in the last few years at the annual reports of CMHC, they've done a fantastically good job of selling mortgage insurance. By 2014, mm-hmm. they will be making something in the range, a net income, that's the sort of governmental term for profit, of about $2 billion a year from their mortgage insurance. Meanwhile, their capacity to be able to take knowledge, information, and generate good policies for government has been mostly stripped away. The Auditor General in Ontario in 2009 did a report on Ontario's affordable housing programs, and the Auditor General's report was quite devastating. The Auditor General said that the affordable housing programs that the government was funding, that the average rents were about twice what people on the affordable housing waiting list could actually afford to pay, so therefore, while the government was building a certain amount of affordable housing, it wasn't actually helping the people who needed it most. Mm-hmm. Talked about the design of rent supplement programs and how they weren't very well designed, and as a result, they weren't being picked up. And the Auditor General concluded that the ministry really didn't have the capacity to actually effectively design, develop, and manage good housing policies. Mm-hmm. And I mention all that because I think that it's a mistake to think that all the people in the research side need to do is to sort of clearly define the problem. So if we come up with a brilliant piece of research that really, really defines the problem well, that we've done our job. We haven't. What we've probably done is gotten a few people to pay attention, but we have to also spend as much time defining solutions. So again, one of the things we do here at the Wellesley Institute with our research partners, like the We Are Neighbors group and so on, is once they had done the really incredible and excellent work of generating the knowledge, we then sat with them and said, okay, well, what do we do? How do we address this in a policy context? What are mm-hmm. the specific issues at City Hall, mm-hmm. Queen's Park, federal government, elsewhere? You know, what are the concrete things that need to be done to take this on? And I think that if you don't attach that policy piece to it, mm-hmm. you can't rely on governments. Maybe 20 or 30 years ago, governments had the policy capacity that you could take a problem to them and say, here's a terrible problem, and they'd look at it and say, you're right, you've done an excellent job of defining the problem, now we'll take it from here and we'll figure out what the solution is. Governments can't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that that's not strict, the dumbing down of government, the gutting of policy capacity has been a deliberate agenda. It's part of a long-term agenda to erode the role of the public sector and the public sphere. But it's certainly the case here. So for me, to kind of, you know, this is a very, very important question, the knowledge translation question, and it has so many important components to it. Mm-hmm. But it's about making sure you've got the right kind of knowledge, and that the knowledge is rich and deep, and it's informed by lived experience, and not just simply by somebody who kind of breezes in and takes 5 minutes and says, "I figured out what your problem is." It also needs to be linked very closely with policy, mm-hmm. and strategy. And the final thing I think that's really important in this whole process is the idea of the value of networks. And one of the big critiques that many of us outside of government have of government is it's way too siloed. So you have Ministry of Health, and you have the Ministry of Education, and you have the Ministry of Community Social Services doing welfare, and the Ministry of Housing, and so on. And so if you have one person, they kind of get divided up amongst all these things, and people's needs are really not very well met in that kind of siloed approach. Mm-hmm. But in outside of government, in the sort of social justice, social advocacy sphere, we often get siloed as well, and that's used against us. So the daycare people go and say, "We need $1 billion for daycare," and the housing people say, "We need $1 billion for housing." And you know, all the other groups are lined up saying we need $1 billion, and all of which is absolutely true, and all of which can be accommodated. But it's very easy when we're divided like that for the government to pick us off. So I'm a very strong advocate for the idea of strong and powerful networks, and we really work very hard to try and build those networks, and we see that as an essential part of the knowledge translation process. Because it's not just about trying to convince the policymakers about something, it's about engaging others and convincing them that we have a common cause and a common struggle mm-hmm. That we can all engage in.
Very informative. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So as you know, the work that I do focuses on LGBTQ youth homelessness. So I was wondering if I could just ask you a few questions and just get your opinion about this. So I'll just start off by asking you, do you think that Toronto is a safe city for LGBTQ youth who are homeless?
No. It's a safer city than some cities I've been in, mm-hmm. in the sense that there is, first of all, it's a bit bigger city than some other communities, and bigger cities often allow people to find niches and to find places where they can sort of survive and find solidarity with others. And I think just the sheer numbers mean it's there. Statistically, though, you know, the reason why I was so categorical in saying no is that, the fact is that just the simple fact of homelessness itself is even in a city like Toronto, where their city spends over $100 million a year on shelters for homeless people and so on, the majority of homeless people don't have access to shelter and services and supports that they need. And it's certainly true in terms of the LGBTQ community that the kind of specialized supports and services that are there, that are needed, I should say, to provide decent support are simply not there. I do want to say that I think Toronto is better than some cities I've been in. I've certainly been in cities in Canada, the United States, and elsewhere that are absolutely terrible. So I don't want to slam my hometown unduly, but we've done reports here at the Wellesley Institute with some of our partners, and we continue to have an association with things like the Teen Sexuality Survey, which has some connections in terms of youth homelessness and so on, and all of those show that. Well, there's some good practices in place, and there's perhaps some awareness, and I think Toronto does have a heightened sense of awareness and support for the community that might not exist in certain other places. I still think we've got a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so a lot of the organizations here in Toronto that serve youth who are homeless happen to be faith-based, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that faith-based organizations put up any specific barriers to youth who are homeless, or more specifically to LGBTQ youth who are homeless?
I think it's a huge issue, and it's one that goes right back long before there were sort of organized government interventions like shelters and so on, it was faith communities that were providing the frontline services for people who were on the margins, poor, destitute, homeless, and so on. And you know, you can look back in the history of Toronto, organizations like Fred Victor's, which is an amazing and very good multi-service center, but it started off 100 and some years ago as you know, just a group of Christian women who just felt very unhappy about the fact that there were homeless people in the streets. So the faith communities have been intertwined, and our notion of providing support for people who are socially, economically, and other ways pushed to the margins has always been wrapped up in a notion, some of the Christian notions of charity and so on. We're doing it because it's nice and because we want to sort of help these unfortunate people, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We want to make them better people. There's been a strong element of morality that flows through our social services that goes back to the kind of Christian roots, our welfare systems and so on, the rules, you know, there have been terrible and pernicious rules in the welfare system about single women cohabiting with men and so on, and a lot of, again, which trace back, and of course with shelters that serve youth, that are faith-based, there are all sorts of issues around things like use of condoms and other sexual health practices. And I can just say as an example that back in the 80s, mid-80s and late 80s, as HIV/AIDS was beginning to emerge and be recognized as a serious health issue, and I was sitting at the time on the Downtown Community Advisory Board of the Board of Health, and we were pressing the City of Toronto to make it a major priority, and I used to have on the desk of my office a big basket of condoms and with a little sign saying take as many as you need and hand them out to your friends and so on. It was a very small little thing, but it was an important thing. But I had a colleague who was an extremely smart, devoted person, and I in many ways I consider that I was mentored by him, but he also had a very strong faith, and among the tenets of his faith was that using condoms was bad, and so we would have this constant battle, and he would sneak into my office and empty out my basket, and then I would refill it, and so on. And that's just, that is such a minor little incident that's being played out, but it's a bigger question. I guess I want to cut to the chase and say that I think that people who get engaged in the work of homeless advocacy who come from a faith perspective are often very powerfully motivated by a sense of social justice, and I think that's great. And I don't think anyone should ever be excluded because they happen to be from a particular background. And we have in Toronto a number of people who are engaged in various aspects of homeless work right across the faith spectrum. Here at the Wellesley Institute, we helped start the Multi-Faith Alliance to End Homelessness, and one of the initial sort of things that group did was come up with a common understanding that in all the major faiths of the world, there is this fundamental notion of justice and injustice, and that people who are homeless definitely fall into the category of people who are being treated unjustly, and that it calls the people from faiths are required to take action on that. Many of the faith-based services that are offered don't necessarily have some of the moral entanglements, but they sometimes can inadvertently take pressure off governments. The Out of the Cold program, which was a wonderful, and food banks indeed, which are often run by churches and other faith organizations, are both excellent emergency responses to a terrible situation. Better somebody stays in a church basement than they stay on the street. Mm-hmm. But the trouble is that when these kinds of things become regularized, then you have a situation where governments feel as if it's up to the faith sector to deal with the wretched and unfortunate, and it's not a responsibility of government acting on behalf of people from a justice perspective. And so we have the terrible obscenity in Toronto, the greater Toronto area, where about 1 million people last year went to food banks in Toronto. many of them food banks in their local churches or other faith settings, and that represents an important emergency response, because better that people are fed and they die of hunger, but it's not an adequate response, and in some ways it takes pressure off of government to actually address the issues that are making people hungry. Mm-hmm. To zero in on youth, throughout the time I've been involved, there's always been a tension between organizations that have brought together and that provide significant services to homeless youth, but bring a certain bundle of beliefs and morality, which they then seek to impose on youth. Mm-hmm. I've been a strong believer in the notion that any organization that gets public funding should be required to observe and respect all the human rights codes, which means they shouldn't discriminate against people, and they shouldn't block access to proper sexual health practices and so on. They shouldn't exclude people based on their gender identity, or they shouldn't attempt to change them or whatever. They shouldn't prevent the use of condoms. This is not a position that is widely supported among policymakers, because their view is that if you stop some of these organizations from doing it, there'll be nobody else to pick up the slack, and better that the kids have a place they can go where they get harassed about using condoms than they have no place at all. And I think that it's an uncomfortable discussion to have, because I think that some of the motivations of these organizations and the people involved in the organizations are very good, and we want to honor that. We want to honor their sense of wanting to build community and engage, but at the same time, we also want to say this: you can't be doing this and pushing your morality or proselytizing. When I first got involved in, to give a dramatic example, when I first got involved in the 80s, there were still gospel missions. Mm-hmm. And these were the places where they're all Christian, and as the name suggests. And what you'd do is you'd go and you'd sit through a service, and you go up to the altar, you accept Jesus as your personal Savior, and then you get a bowl of soup and some food. Well, miracle of all miracles, there were people going up there every day, getting saved in order to get their bowl of soup. And I used to have ferocious arguments with the people running these things. And I said, do you think any of this is at all sincere, or are these just hungry, desperate people who are willing to debase themselves, mm-hmm. and play a stupid little game with you,
yeah.
Just in order to get some soup because they're hungry? We don't have any gospel missions, at least as far as I know. We don't have any left in Toronto. I don't know if there are in other parts of... There probably still are in the United States, sadly. Mm-hmm. that use the provision of basic services as a bat to try and beat people into accepting their religious views. I think that's profoundly offensive. I also think it's really stupid, and I don't think anybody actually ever got saved, mm-hmm. or whatever term they want. Here in Toronto, there is the City of Toronto has had a requirement that anyone that contracts with the city has to agree to basic human rights provisions, but that's never been effectively enforced in terms of shelters. And I guess the final point I would say on this is that the reason why this is such a sharp issue for LGBTQ youth is that we don't have that many youth shelters, and the ones that we have are in fact very closely associated with certain faiths. Mm-hmm. And in our society, we haven't, there still is a huge amount of tension around issues of gender identity, sexual orientation, and so on. And it's especially, I think, an issue for young people. When I say an issue for young people, I mean it's an issue for those of us who are older who impose these things. So I think... now, I do want to stop and say that... we've done some, in the various segments of the LGBTQ community, like the trans community, we've done some specific work with the city, and we found on an individual basis that city officials and shelter operators are extremely understanding and supportive of the idea that the trans population is a specific group within the broader community that have I hate using the term special needs, but I'm sorry, I'm not thinking of a better term, that specific support and training for staff in terms of working with the trans community, specific programs and services, facilities, and so on, are all even this the fundamental issue of which washroom do trans people use when they're only given two options, a male or a female, and we found the city has actually been, when we've kind of moved away from the political spotlight and sat down with individual city officials, that they're very supportive, sympathetic, and willing to want to engage in a process that makes sure that shelters actually respect various groups. The trouble is, however, that that doesn't seem to translate into a lot of change, and you know, I guess there are two processes that need to happen, and they sound like they might be contradictory, but I think they're actually parallel processes that need to happen at the same time. One is that we need to get our entire shelter system to be more gay positive, in every sense of that word, and to ensure that the physical facilities, the staff, and so on, are all up to a proper standard. That's one initiative, but we also need to have specialized services and supports and shelters. And I'm not a sort of believer that we should be segregating and segmenting and slicing the population into little groups and saying you have to pick, you know, which group you identify with, and that's the shelter you get to stay at. I think people should have an option of staying in a shelter in which they share an identity with other people in that shelter. I think there can be some comfort, support, solidarity out of that, but they should also have the option of being able to go into a more general shelter and also get the support services and facilities that they need in a general shelter. So those are the two streams that need to be taken in the Toronto shelter system. The good news is, from people who we work with, who are very much involved with various parts of the LGBTQ community, we hear that Toronto does a better job of listening and engaging than a lot of other cities. The bad news is that we still aren't quite as far as we need to be in terms of actually putting in place the solutions, making sure the funding's there. And I guess the bad news is that the more that we're dealing with the sort of general economic distress that's washing over Canada, United States, the rest of the world since the big recession of 2008, the more governments are inclined to say, you know, we want to cut back on everything, including our support for specialized services and programs, and that means that it's you know, I think we're actually at risk of moving farther away from solutions as governments say this is not a priority for us. We've got to focus on other issues. So it's kind of hard in the clamor of voices to get these discussions happening.
Certainly, yeah, there certainly is a lot more work to be done in this area, for sure. That's great. Thank you very much, Michael. That was really informative. Is there anything else that maybe I didn't ask you about that you wanted to add in before we end off?
Well, I just think it's really great to have these kinds of conversations, because my view is that we especially as Canadians, I have a rather naive but I think very powerful belief that there's a fundamental sort of sense of justice that most Canadians have. Opinion polls that we've seen and so on all say that people are horrified at the terrible situation facing people who are homeless generally, and they do want specific action to be taken. They don't want people to be sentenced to a life on the streets. We understand that you know, more and more, the huge amount of research that's being done in United States and Canada in terms of the impact of long-term homelessness, chronic homelessness, as it's sometimes called, is that it absolutely has a deep and irrevocable physical, mental impact on people's lives. The real priority for all of us now is an approach that's been called in the United States housing first, or sometimes rapid rehousing. And I think it's especially, it's important for every group within the homeless population, but especially homeless youth, that we know that the longer people are in insecure housing, precarious housing, or in a situation where they're directly experiencing homelessness, the more likely the deep and serious health impacts are gonna cut deeper, and the harder it's gonna be for people to be able to move into a healthy and more stable housing situation. Mm-hmm. And so the absolute priority is what we. What we call housing first, which is to sort of quickly get people into a good and decent place. And there's not a lot of magic to doing this. We actually know what some of the key levers are. We know, for instance, that one of the most important things is to get money into the pockets of people so they can actually move into either subsidized housing or market housing, depending on their particular situation. And here in Toronto, for instance, a few years ago, the City of Toronto started a project called Streets to Homes. And the whole idea of the project was to rapidly rehouse homeless people by getting them onto welfare very, very quickly. And it actually is not a magic formula, and it's been very successful in its particular sort of limited terms, because they've actually come up with a way of moving people very quickly into welfare and then into available housing. And as I say, this is not, in the 21st century, it's not that tough. I can walk down to my local credit union, as my wife and I did a few years ago, fill out an application. 20 minutes later, they can tell us whether we can get $500,000 loan to buy a house. So if my local credit union can figure out how to assess that, then welfare officials should be able to figure out in half an hour whether somebody's qualified for welfare. So we know these things are working. The problem for youth, of course, is that there are so many barriers to actually accessing welfare. There's so many rules and restrictions and so on that we actually have to also address a number of other issues. But we know that a lot of these very, very basic mechanisms. We also know, and I really want to sort of emphasize this point, that the rise in mass homelessness in Canada in the 1990s and into the last decade didn't happen because we suddenly forgot how to build housing, that we suddenly had this massive shortage of housing all across the country. At the same time that we were generating record waiting lists for affordable housing, record numbers of homeless people in shelters, record numbers of homeless people on the streets, we were also building almost near record amounts of housing. Mm-hmm. Toronto, best example of that. You can see all over the city, even now, 2 years into the recession, we've still got lots of construction activity happening. It's down a little bit from what it was 2 years ago, but not a lot. So the problem is not that we've forgotten how to build housing. The problem is that the housing we're building is not accessible to people that need it. It's just looking out the window of my office, it's these high-rise condominiums that are 30 and 40 stories high, and they're full of tiny little overpriced units that people who desperately need housing can't get into. There is a simple mechanism, a simple solution to that, to open up some of this kind of housing. And it's another initiative the Wellesley Institute has been pushing called inclusionary housing. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of U.S. cities have requirements, specific mechanisms in their planning and zoning bylaws that every time a developer builds a condo building like the one right next to our office, mm-hmm. that they have to set aside 10%. 15%, 20%, 25%, depending on the community, of that housing for affordable housing for low-income people, including, for instance, homeless youth. Mm-hmm. And there are specific mechanisms, and it's obviously can get a little bit more complicated in terms of the how it actually works out, and different cities have different ways of actually doing it. But we've looked at these models across the United States, and we've said there's some real value in importing those models and adapting them, making them work in Canada. So I think the solution to homelessness, and I believe we can actually end homelessness, not just simply make it a little bit less or make it life more comfortable for homeless people. We could actually end homelessness in Canada, including youth homelessness, by addressing some of the fundamental issues, the income piece, mm-hmm. the housing piece, and the services piece, and they all sort of work together. The first thing we have to do, though, is to start having this adult conversation about youth homelessness. We have to move away from the pathology of saying that, you know, certain people make me upset because I don't like their gender identity, or I don't like what they've got in their nose, or the tattoo they've got on their arm, or whatever it is. And we have to sort of move beyond all those things that are dividing people, and actually talk about how we can solve all these issues. And I believe we can. And I want to say one final thing, final thing about all this. I really think that you know, we've moved away from over the last 20 or 30 years from the idea that we used to have a sense that government could be a partner in the solution. And so, you know, the last half a century, we have had brilliant initiatives in Canada, like our national healthcare program, where we actually said we can't allow healthcare to be delivered by private sector, because that means that rich people will get good healthcare and poor people will die, and that's not acceptable. So we turned to our government and we said we want our government to actually be a partner with the people of Canada in creating a national healthcare program that'll ensure everyone gets good access to good primary healthcare services. In recent years, government has not been a very reliable partner, you know, governments have cut housing programs, governments have cut even the policy capacity, the ability to be even to implement solutions. And I think what that means is that we need to see a rise in what we call here at the Wellesley Institute the third sector, or the community nonprofit sector. I think there's actually some real promise here. I would like to see, as we've seen in a limited extent up until now, but more and more initiatives, whether it's hostels and services and supports for homeless youth, or housing projects, permanent housing projects, employment and that sort of thing. I'd like to see youth-owned, youth-managed, and youth-led initiatives. We're a small project that I manage here at the Wellesley Institute is called You for Change, and it's a arts-based youth employment and training program. At the moment, we've got about 100 young people who are many of whom have experienced homelessness, who are engaged in this, and it's a wonderful initiative, but it's not particularly complicated in the sense that what we're doing is working with young people to help them to develop their skills and then to get into the to the job market. But as part of that initiative, we're working on related projects, like a project called Youth Build, which is a pattern on a U.S. model where young people actually come together and build housing and manage it. So I think if there's a sort of direction going forward out of these kind of bleak times that we live in, where we're seeing a continued rise in homelessness, and a continued erosion of government support, is that we have another option. And for us, it's really important to sort of focus in on making that a reality. And I think that's going to be a big focus of our work going forward. And I'm really excited by the idea that we can actually create new models, new for Canada, not new for the world, but new for Canada, in which youth are not coming cap in hand to adults and saying, will you please show us a little bit of mercy and some charity, but youth actually organizing and saying, this is what we need, this is how we want to see these supports and services organized, and this is what we need in terms of making it a reality, and then actually youth managed, youth led, youth owned, youth operated supports and services. And I think that would be very, very exciting, and we need to put some of our thinking into what that would actually look like and how we can make that happen, how we can get the money in place and the supports and so on.
Definitely. So thank you very much for sharing your expertise.
Great, thanks.